Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome and thanks so much for joining us tonight to welcome the amazing Frank DeFord to the Seattle Public Library. So first, we thank Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this evening, the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, who's here with us tonight somewhere. And finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. The foundation represents thousands of people in our community who give gifts, large and small, to support our libraries. That private support is what makes possible so many of our free library programs. So to all of you foundation donors who are here with us tonight, we want to say thank you very, very much for your support.
Thank you, Chris. And it's a great pleasure and honor to have Frank DeFord here. He's here with a book, which actually different people who keep track of him in different ways are surprised sometimes because he's got this whole life as a novelist. He's got a whole, has had a remarkable career as a sports journalist, which has taken the form of several books. But he's here for tonight for a book which in a way encompasses many of them, and then some. This book entitled Over Time, My Life as a Sports Writer. It's a book that goes over the arc of his working life, which is now over 50 years, when he about just past the 50-year mark, when he was a graduate of Princeton, and in that sort of the way things happened for and to young men coming out of a place like Princeton, he was able to step in at a very opportune time as a journalist at a magazine that was really not really on the radar yet of prominent magazines, that being Sports Illustrated, and furthermore took on a role that didn't seem so promising given its status in the pantheon of sports, that being pro basketball, when it was really a barely visible, evident thing on the whole national horizon. And indeed, the book looks at, in various ways, that great transformation of the place of sports, both in actuality and in the reporting that goes with them. It's a book that touches on many things. Incredible stories in this book, incredibly rich. Arthur Ashe, Wilt Chamberlain, Billie Jean King. So again, for the Seattle Public Library Foundation, for the Seattle Public Library, for Elliott Bay, we thank you again for being here tonight. And now ask you please in joining in welcoming the wonderful and delightful Frank DeFord.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you, Chris, and thank you all for coming out. This is a favorite city of mine for a lot of reasons. I've did one story here, perhaps the most interesting journey I ever took in sports. I drove from here to Oakland, California with Bill Russell. He did all the driving, I did all the listening. It was a wonderful... And in my other life, I was the chairman of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, and Seattle was the first city in the country to have a $1 million event. So I've never forgotten that either. That means a great deal to me. And it's sort of a coincidence that you're having the rally tonight to bring a basketball team back here, because actually I did the first story on the Sonics, at least for any sort of national exposure, when they first appeared here. I came here and did a story on the first day that Lenny Wilkins, who was the coach then, and Tom Machete, who was the assistant coach, brought that expansion team together, and I did the piece. So I feel like we've sort of come full circle. And now about my book, which began as a piece in Sports Illustrated because the editor, Terry McDonald, was, I think, taken by Mad Men, for those of you who see Mad Men on television, and wanted me to write about the early days of Sports Illustrated back in the 1960s, a time that my late friend David Halberstam called the golden age of magazines. And after all, magazines and advertisers were sort of, in New York anyway, were kind of first cousins for each other. And sure enough, we men drank entirely too much and smoked entirely too much. And the women were all called girls, of course, and somehow we managed to get out a magazine every week. And I wrote an article about that. And then Morgan Intrakun, the publisher of the Atlantic Monthly Press, asked me to expand it into a book. And I was very reluctant to do that. I have, you see, two strikes against me as a storyteller. First of all, I had an incredibly happy childhood. That is a real bummer, a real negative for anybody who wants to write a memoir. Ideally, you want to have grown up in abject poverty with a father who beats you and a mother who is a hooker, although a saint on the side. And so you can pull yourself up by the bootstraps, and I couldn't do that. And the second thing is that I'm not a minority, which is another thing which is good for writing memoirs. And not only am I not a minority, I'm not a woman. Do you know that 6 out of every 7 novels are read by women? So the last novel I wrote it as a woman to try to take advantage of that. But writing a memoir about me as a woman was out of the question. So I'm hopelessly trapped in this majority status. In fact, it was a Hollywood agent who once said to me, DeFord, you are the last of the tall, white, WASP, heterosexual, Episcopalian, Ivy League writers. That's me. I am a Huguenot, but it's been 300 or more years since we were persecuted by the Catholics, so it's very hard to gin up any sympathy for me in that regard. So I said no thank you to writing a memoir. But Morgan Intrakun, the editor, came up with an idea, and I must say this, that normally as a writer, through the years, I have fought editors tooth and nail all my life. I generally subscribe to the thoughts of an old newspaper man, a famous old newspaper man named Gene Fowler, who said, every editor should have a pimp for a brother so they would have someone in the family to look up to. But for once, an editor had a pretty good idea. To say a little something about sports writing, because not to feel sorry for myself, but people put sports writing down as sort of the junk bonds of journalism. In fact, I found that whenever anybody is nice enough to compliment me, they always say something in this vein. Frank, that was really a lovely piece. It was so good, in fact, that it's not sports writing. In other words, if it's any good, it can't possibly be sports writing. It has to be something else again. So I thought, though, that I could sprinkle a little bit about sports writing into the memoir. And still, I was dubious that I had enough material. I mean, after all, writers just write. I mean, that's what we do. That's not very exciting. If you look at the cover of the book, it's just me hugging a typewriter. And there's not a whole lot that you can make out of that. But my wife, Carol, changed my mind. Let me backtrack a moment first and go back to that time, that Mad Men time in the 1960s. My editor then was a man named Andre Laguerre, an extraordinary man. How many of us ever have our first boss turn out to be the most extraordinary and the most interesting and the most intriguing and the best boss that we'll ever have in our life. Well, that was me with Laguerre. André was a Frenchman. Amazing that it was a Frenchman who made Sports Illustrated work in the United States. He also was responsible later on for the swimsuit issue, but that's that's another story you may want to ask me about. Laguerre was de Gaulle's press secretary during the war. He had been literally plucked out of the English Channel amidst the flames at Dunkirk. He had covered Munich when he was 23 years old. He was almost killed by a bomb in Saigon during the Indochina War. He's this fascinating, idiosyncratic Frenchman. And there were two things that I remember that he told me that I shall never forget. First of all, after I'd been at Sports Illustrated for 5 or 6 years, and I was beginning to wonder whether I really wanted to be a sports writer all my life. I had fallen into sports writing. I came to Sports Illustrated really because I admired the writing, not so much because I wanted to be a sports writer. And I told André that, and he said, "Frankie," I was still very young and went by the diminutive then, "Frankie, it doesn't matter what you write about, it only matters how well you write about it." In other words, it's the subject that doesn't matter, it's the craft that matters. And I never forgot that. The other thing that he told me that I remember very distinctly was one night at the bar, and we were often at the bar, as I said, in those days. He said, "Frankie, every writer has a choice to make. You can either drink with the boys or chase the girls, but you can't do both if you want to be a good writer." Standing next to me was a wonderful writer named Ron Finwright, who was then going through his second or third divorce, and he said, "Now you tell me." So anyway, a few months after that, I told André that I was going to get married. And I shall never forget this. He took his scotch, shook his head, put it down, and said, this romantic Frenchman, "Frankie, that's the worst news I've heard in months." Now, I was making $10,000 at that time, which is a pretty good salary for the early 1960s, the mid-1960s. He said, "I tell you what, if you don't marry her, I'll give you a $3,000 raise." How many of you have had a 30% raise? That's a lot. And standing there next to André was Tix Maul, the football writer, who himself had been married on numerous occasions, and he said, I'll give you another $1,000 on my own." But I married the girl. And so now we get back to the her. And one of the reasons that we have managed to stay together for so long is that we have sort of this post-nuptial agreement that I will never show her anything I write until it is published. I am always amazed at these books which have acknowledgments, which say in effect, "I want to thank my dear wife or my dear husband for helping me so with this book, for helping me with my research, for copy editing, for checking my mistakes, for making suggestions." It absolutely astonishes me. I look at it this way, that if I show Carol something that I'm working on and she says she likes it, I immediately decide that she's lying and patronizing me and I don't like her. And if she says she doesn't like it, I out and out hate her. It's a lose-lose proposition. I think marriage is tenuous enough without testing it any further. The other post-nuptial agreement we have is that she does not have to ever come and hear me speak. But the poor thing has heard me late at night talking to friends on enough occasions, I'm afraid, and it was at this point that she said, "Yeah, you ought to write the book because of all those stories I've heard. You tell the boys late at night, and you've got plenty of stories, and yes, you ought to do it. And so I decided to do it. But, you know, generally, people who write memoirs about themselves have lived these exciting and glamorous words. Think of the word memoir. It's really, if you break it down, memoir. And this book of mine is more we more, because it's not just about me. It's about me and all the fascinating and intriguing people that I've been lucky enough to work with and meet and encounter during my life. And Carol's right. I've fallen into so many interesting adventures as a writer. For instance, I stumbled into tennis. Tennis back in the 1960s was a third-rate sport. It was still an amateur game. The players paid a little under the table. No self-respecting, hard-drinking, fedora-wearing sports writer wanted anything to do with it. But when I was offered a chance to do a tennis story, I leapt at it. I was looking for any chances whatsoever. And while I was on it, it occurred to me, when I do a basketball story, I'm in Wichita, Kansas, or Bloomington, Indiana. You do a tennis story, you're in Paris and London. What are these other sports writers missing? And that's how I became a tennis writer. And just at the time when the sport began to bloom. This, you know, is the 40th anniversary of Title IX. This next week, as a matter of fact. But even before then, Billie Jean King was kicking over rocks and raising hell out there on the tennis tour. And I was lucky enough to be riding in the sidecar with her while she was really making history. I really do consider her the single most culturally important athletic figure of the 20th century. You remember the expression consciousness raising? I named the chapter about Billie Jean consciousness raising because it was she who raised my consciousness. And then at the same time, or about the same time, that she was changing the way that little girls thought about sports, and for that matter, how everybody thought about little girls playing sports, there was another vital sports tennis hero who came on the scene, and that was Arthur Ashe. And I had the opportunity eventually to actually live with Arthur when he went to Johannesburg and broke the color line in South Africa. We was working on a book with him at the time, and we'd actually lived together there. He was the first black entertainer, never mind just athlete, to perform on the same stage or the same court with whites. And it changed everything. At that time, no one could imagine a future without apartheid in South Africa. But once he pulled back that curtain just a little bit and let that light in, there was no closing it. He really played a crucial role in history, and I was there. And there have been somewhat other less important occasions. Talk about being embedded. I once emceed the annual Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue publicity tour. I reluctantly agreed to do this. They gave us the Time Incorporated corporate jet, and we flew all over America. I was the only man on the plane, except for the pilots, and they were supposed to pay attention to flying the plane. And there I was in the back with all the models. I'll never forget. We spent Valentine's Day together. Elle McPherson, Rachel Hunter, Carol Alt, and me in Detroit. I had the distinction of being the chosen sports writer on the Light Beer All-Stars. You remember that? Tastes great, less filling. What a wonderful bunch of guys. And of course, so much of it is luck. For instance, when I first appeared at Sports Illustrated, the year before, when I'd been a senior at Princeton, Bill Bradley had been a freshman. And in those days, the freshmen were not allowed to play on the varsity team. They just played each other. And how many people had seen the Princeton freshman team play the likes of, you know, Cornell and Brown and so forth? And so I told the people at Sports Illustrated, the basketball experts, that the best sophomore player in the country was down at Princeton. And of course, they all laughed at me and joked. But finally, they gave me threw me a bone and let me do a story. It was really about the first big story that I'd ever done on this kid. And Bradley, of course, turned out to be even better than I imagined. And that made me look like a genius. They said, this kid really knows his stuff. I've told Bill often that he was a real springboard to my career. Years later, too, when I was covering basketball, every year I would be with the Boston Celtics, because every year, led by the Seattle resident Mr. Russell, they would be in the finals. And the other Boston winter team was the Bruins, and they were as bad as the Celtics were good. But in those days, in Canada, they would take the best players, virtually wean them away from their mother's breast, and promise them to a team in the NHL. And there was a kid named Bobby Orr, who was the best, and so he was promised to the worst team, the Bruins. And every year, I would hear the Boston writers say, three more years and Bobby Orr will be here. Two more years. One more year, he'll be 18, and he can play for us. You've got to understand, I didn't know a hockey puck from a badminton bird. But I went back to Sports Illustrated and told them, you know, I know that the greatest hockey player is about to join the Boston Bruins. And off I went to Parry Sound, way up in Ontario. I'll never forget it. I was having breakfast that morning in the only place in town, and I asked the waitress if she knew where the Orrs lived, and she said yes, she did, because she was Mrs. Orr. And sure enough, Bobby Orr turned out to be everything that I said he would be, and once again, I was a genius and moved up. Actually, years later, long after Bobby's career had ended, I was doing a story on Larry Bird, who I did not discover, by the way. And we were in Boston, where there was a presentation was being made. They were unveiling a statue of Bird. It was late in his career. And I looked over at the cocktail party ahead of time, and there was Bobby Orr, and we hadn't seen each other in years. And when it was time for the presentation to be made, Bobby and I sat down next to each other, and Bird stood up. And by then, Bird had a certain amount of sophistication, a hick from southern Indiana, and he started to speak, and he said, you know, before every game, I look up to all those banners at the Boston Garden, but there's only one that I zero in on, and everybody... And he said, it's number 4. And everybody started thinking, number 4, Russell's number 6, Havlicek's number 17. And then he paused and he said, Bobby Orr. And Orr reached out, you know, without unconsciously, subconsciously, and grabbed my hand and squeezed it and said, oh my God, Frank, oh my God. It was the greatest compliment he could have received, that a superstar from another sport had treated him in that way. It was one of the most touching moments I ever had in all of sport. Amazing the things that more or less fell into my lap when I think about it. I never was a George Plimpton type, but I did do some crazy things. I wrestled a bear once. He beat me in 8 seconds flat that bear. I rode in a race car with Danica Patrick, scared me to death. And I had a racehorse named after me too, Frank DeFord. He couldn't run a lick. I couldn't either. The other Frank DeFord couldn't run a lick. My basketball coach at Princeton said, "DeFord, you write basketball better than you play it." And that was pretty much the end of my career, except for one time years later when I was doing a story on the Harlem Globetrotters. And we were traveling through Italy together, and we got to know each other pretty well. And the Globetrotters asked me to play against them. You know, they bring the Stooges along. And they thought that I would fit in as a stooge. And I was reluctant to do it, but I finally decided, well, vanity got the best of me. And I thought, well, I'll play them the last night that I'm with them. Because then if I'm made a fool of, I'll be gone the next day. It was in Bologna. And I mean, we're talking about 10, 12,000 people there. And I think I acquitted myself very well. I certainly did better than I had that time against the bear in any event. But the best of it is that if you're tall, as I am, the first thing that people ask you is, "Did you play basketball?" Abraham Lincoln in heaven, that's what people ask him. And I'm now able to say, well, yeah, I played a little pro ball in Italy. So it's been such an eclectic time. I think the one athlete who left me in the most awe was Sir Edmund Hillary, he who conquered the last bit of real estate on the face of the earth. But at the other extreme, I think the best people that I ever met and did a story with were the men and women of the roller derby. They were wonderful. I adored them. The best advice I ever got came from Colonel Harlan Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken. The most irritated I ever got was when Don King twice stood me up. I lost $150 million running a sports newspaper and did it in 18 months. I think that's a journalistic record. But I came along, I know, at just the right time to be a sports writer. And under the guise, if you will, of being a sports writer, under that umbrella, I've been able to write about every element of the human condition. Not just the X's and O's and who wins the games. I've done really very little of that, but mostly writing about all the drama and the glamour of sport. You know, it's a wonderful thing to write about. Somebody wins and somebody loses every day, and I have been able to write about all the emotions, about religion and sex and death and glory. Really, it's a secret I probably shouldn't tell you, but if you can't write about sports, you ought to get out of the business, because it provides such a wonderful canvas for a writer to paint his words upon. So I think I've been very, very lucky to have been this troubadour of sports for the last half century. It sounds impossible to say, but that's true. And I hope I've been able to signal some of that in my memoir in overtime. Now, as Yogi Berra said, what's a writer's speech without a citation to Yogi? Yogi and Phil Rizzuto a few years ago were tooling down the road in New Jersey on the way to a dinner and moving happily along, but Rizzuto began to get worried. He said, "Yogi said, I think we're lost." And Yogi said, "Yeah, but we're making such good time." And with that as my scripture, I'm going to stop now. But I welcome any of those questions that you that you may have for me. Thank you so very much for it. Yes, right there. Oh, what did Colonel Sanders tell me? I piqued your interest, didn't I? Okay. I was at the Palmer House in Chicago covering an NCAA convention, which is a fate worse than death for a journalist. And I came down in the morning to the counter there in the dining room, and there was one seat left, one from the end. And I sat down, and I happened to glance over at that point and notice that the gentleman sitting next to me was Colonel Harlan Sanders. You remember him, surely. And he was dressed in his full Kentucky Fried Chicken attire. And I didn't say anything to him, but he struck up a conversation with me. He was not eating chicken in the morning. It was some sort of oatmeal gruel. And we had a nice conversation, and when he was finished, he stood up. And remember, he looked like God. As close to God as any man could, you know, the white hair, the white beard, the white suit, the white cane, the whole outfit. And he said, "Son, I've enjoyed talking to you, and so I want to give you the best advice I can." I said, "Yes, sir." I mean, I'm standing there talking to God. And he paused and he said, "If you want people to listen to you," I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Wear a white suit." "Yes, sir." The question is, my road trip with Mr. Russell to Oakland, we were going to see his father, who was in a home down, an old people's home down there. It was sort of a trip back in time for Bill. And this was 1999. And the reason I was doing this story was that friends of Russell had convinced him that he was being forgotten, that things moved too fast, that kids today had no idea who Bill Russell was. And if he wanted to be remembered, and the century was turning, so it mattered, he had to sort of come out of hiding. You know, he's a very private guy. And so it was decided, he agreed and asked me to do a story for Sports Illustrated. And that was the reason for it. It's hard to believe that someone is as good as Russell could be forgotten, but it does move so quickly. A friend of mine who teaches a journalism course told me just the other day that he mentioned one time Howard Cosell and Muhammad Ali, and they're, you know, the act. He said there were 20 people, 20 students in the there. Not a single one of them knew who Howard Cosell was, and only about half of them even knew who Muhammad Ali was. That's how fast it all moves. Yes, ma'am. I have not written on the Seattle Storm, but I did a piece. I come from Connecticut, and we got a pretty good team there. You know, we got a pretty good team. Half the Olympic team is made up of UConn players. Unfortunately, the coach is in a little bit hot water these days, but I did a long story on Gino Auriemma and women's basketball for the television show that I worked for, Real Sports with Brian Gumbel. So I have not missed women's basketball. The most important event that I ever watched, I don't know if I don't think of sports events as important. I mean, I'm not putting them down, but it doesn't make any difference whether it's the World Series or the NBA Finals or the U.S. Open. They're all important to the people who play in them. I certainly think the greatest upset, unfortunately, in a kid from Baltimore was when Joe Namath led the New York Jets over my Baltimore Colts, my beloved Baltimore Colts, who moved to Indiana just like your beloved Sonics moved somewhere. Get over it. It happens to everybody. Yeah. Yes, sir. The question is, have I ever thought about putting all of my NPR commentaries on a CD? No, the answer is no. I never have thought about that. The question was, did they make Arthur Ashe an honorary white? They did have a custom then. That's how cynical they were. Particularly when they were dealing with Japan for financial reasons. They would make the Asians honorary whites so that they could come into the country and stay in the hotels and so forth. But no, Arthur came in as a black man. He handled those negotiations, which took 3 or 4 years. I mean, I think if Arthur had lived, he'd have been a wonderful diplomat. And he worked that out himself, and it was understood without any question whatsoever that he was coming in as a black man. We went down into the black township of Soweto. It was cut and dried. There was no monkey business. He had managed to gain entrance to this tournament, and it was a big tournament then, the South African Open. And he came as a black man and played as a black man. The preeminent player of the 1960s. Well, that would have to be Russell. I mean, anybody who won whatever he won, 11 championships. I just don't think you can get around it. I have a chapter in my book, really it's very poignant, on his great rival, Wilt Chamberlain. And I mean, the world was divided into, you know, Russell people and Chamberlain people. And a case can certainly be made that Chamberlain was the more extraordinary physical specimen. But there were some great players. Elgin Baylor was a magnificent player. He's been largely forgotten, which is a shame. Oscar Robertson was a fabulous player. I think by the end of that decade, Jerry West is probably the best player in the league, but I don't think anybody can. I don't think Russell could take a back seat to anybody. Maybe of all time, yes, sir. Should the NCAA pay their players? Of course they should. I mean that's inexcusable. That's un-American. Look, once upon a time, you don't have to go back very far. There were a lot of sports around the world in which the athletes didn't get paid, or at least didn't get paid officially. They got paid under the table. I mean, tennis was that way, as I mentioned, skiing, swimming, track and field. All of those sports eventually became legitimate, and the athletes were paid. As they were in all other sports. The only place that's left in the world where big money is made in sports and the players are not paid is in the United States of America, in college football, in college basketball. It's the only place. And maybe it could have been justified when the coaches were making, you know, normal salary. You know, Johnny Wooden, the most he ever made was $42,000. And now, you know, they sign coaches for $3 million contracts like nothing. And the players get absolutely nothing. And it's just, it's obscene. It's obscene. The question was, when Magic Johnson announced that he had AIDS, how was that treated by sports writers? First of all, it astonished everybody. I don't think anybody had any idea whatsoever. I mean, it came completely out of the blue. There were naturally all kinds of rumors that floated around, but I don't think that those were restricted to sports writers. And Magic was a very popular guy. And so the fact that he was popular with the press, and I have a little chapter in there which is kind of a tribute to him in a way, it certainly helped. I think everybody was rooting for him. I don't remember, I mean, there was a certain amount of cynicism, but then there's a certain amount of cynicism with journalists no matter what. And there were an awful lot of people who, as I said, gossiped a lot. But I don't remember anything being extraordinary about it. All I remember was that Arthur was convinced that once that happened, that it would be revealed that he had AIDS. And he was amazed that he was still able to keep the secret for another 6 months. That's what I remember about that. How amazing it was that even though some members of the press had learned that Arthur had AIDS, they still kept the secret, which was one of the great tributes to anybody in public life. I think the second part is easier than the first. Is there any other athlete who Lance Armstrong reminds me of? No, I can't. I mean, for somebody to come back from cancer as he did, A, and B, as controversial as he is otherwise, that's a real twofer. And I can't think of anybody who's come back from cancer to the extent, or from any serious disease to the extent that he did. Now, the first part of your question, if I understand it, is in time, when we accept the fact that just about everybody in bicycle racing was doping, will we give him more credit? Is that in other words, everybody was cheating, so he was better under the. That's maybe. You know, maybe over time people will say that. Maybe over time people will say about all the guys on baseball steroids. Well, the pitchers. Like Clemens, they were all on steroids. Everybody was on steroids. So we might as well disregard the fact that that they were cheating, because everybody was cheating. And everybody wasn't cheating in baseball, but it's possible that attitude will come up. I think if it does, though, it's going to take a long, long time before that happens. I think that there have just been so many scandals in bicycle racing. It's just been so tarnished that I think it'll be a while before Armstrong, is ever given his due.
Do you think that Edgar Martinez should be in the Hall of Fame?
Because it's hard to hit a baseball, should Edgar Martinez be in the Hall of Fame? I don't think he's quite good enough. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people who are very close, but if I had a vote, and I don't have a vote, so, you know, I'm not in the Baseball Writers Association, you know, I just think he's, you know, there are really, really good players who just aren't quite good enough for the Hall of Fame, and that's where I would rank him. But would I be shocked if he got into the Hall of Fame? Would I be upset? No. Because, you know, he's close. But some of them just are close and they just don't quite make it. And it happens all the time. Yes, sir?
Based on your knowledge of the gentleman, how many women do you feel Wilt Chamberlain slept with?
What was the question?
Did he ever leave an interview in the middle to go have sex with a woman?
I said, I had a real poignant chapter on Wilt Chamberlain, and that was about the question. And you have to read the book. Yes. What was the question?
Let me ask it again. What's the question?
What was the question?
Well, the question was just comment about that story. Does that story fit to you and your view of Ted Williams?
But repeat what you said.
The story is that with Ted Williams.
Who was the greatest center fielder I ever saw play? Just playing center field. See, an Oriole fan was a guy named Paul Blair, who played about 5 feet behind second base because he was so fast. Now, you're probably asking the greatest all-around center fielder. And, you know, I think it's difficult to get away from Mays. I would follow, you know, what all the experts say on that score. Though some would say that if Mantle had not been injured in that World Series, he might well have, you know, been the better of the two. And what was my reaction when the Dodgers and Giants left? I, like everybody else, you know, I was shocked. I don't remember having any other. It was cataclysmic in terms of baseball, but life went on. Now we got one more question. Yes.
Why do you sports write? Why do you write about sports?
Why do I write about sports? And the question is, why do I write about sports? And the preface was that David Halberstam, who wrote about sports, right? That he said it was the totality of sports that mattered. That's a pretty good answer. But I write about sports because, as I said, it's a wonderful canvas to write upon. And yes, sports are just fun and games on one level, but it's also true that in every society that's ever existed, in every culture, there have been sports. I mean, it's a little bit deeper than just an amusement. And any one particular game matters, you know, nothing. But as David Halberstam says, it's the totality and what sports means to so many people. So I'm writing about something that's not altogether insignificant, but which does, in fact, have some place in this human world. And it's not as important. It's not necessary. It's not like eating and procreation. But the two things that are unnecessary in this world, unnecessary, but are found in every culture, are sports and religion. We could live without both, but they are everywhere. So by that, I'm not trying to tie sports to religion, but I am saying they're the two things that we find everywhere. So they matter. At the end of the day, they matter. Thank you all so much.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.